Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, October 12th, 2006. And good evening. Many topics to cover tonight. First of all, I'm going to pre-announce the science topics for the evening, which I'll try and get into very soon after a couple quick announcements, talking about the creativity for students in a stifling educational atmosphere where teachers are strapped to basically a curriculum. They cannot vary from this curriculum, and students have to sit there classroom after classroom and be educated. Where's the creativity? Well, they try and squeeze a little bit in. Anyway, I'll talk more about that in the science topic. And that brings up something very interesting. Back in the, I believe it was in the late 60s, there was a book called The Peter Principle. And, published 1969. And I'll be talking about that as it applies to science. Then I'm going to be talking quickly about the Upthrust Mountains discovered on the ring, the moon Iapetus of Saturn. Very interesting construct in the solar system and how it got there. First, a couple quick announcements. Very interesting. This past week, I got many calls on this. Apparently, a couple of people, including Rush Limbaugh, announcing that this topic, let's put it into perspective. June 10th, in Pravda, there was an announcement made. The name of the article, June 10th, 2006, it says, this is from English translation of the science section of Pravda, of course, the Russian newspaper out of Moscow. Giant comet may collide with Earth late October. And it referred back to an astronomer, and let me get his name, Fedorovsky was his name, allegedly, who made a claim that he had seen a comet through a telescope and made some quick calculations and said it was going to crash into Earth at the end of October. Well, nothing could be farther from the truth. But at any rate, interestingly enough, at the end of the Pravda article, it actually discounts what he was saying by a number of other prominent scientists from Russia, basically saying that no, these kind of things are not in the works for Earthlings. But at any rate, be that as it may, the question, and of course when it came out at the time, I was asked to comment on it on radio shows, and it caused some flurry, as these kind of announcements do, because allegedly it was attributed to an actual Russian astronomer, professional astronomer. And it looks, from the commentary, it's like he just went out in his backyard, kind of looked through a telescope, saw a comet, made some calculations, and said it's going to hit Earth at the end of October. So anyway, I'll talk more about the reality of making such calculations and observations. But first, in spite of the story, which was a non-story at the time, what's really curious is that on the same day, October 10th, which is July, August, September, October, 4 months after the original Pravda news release, Rush Limbaugh comes up with this and announces it on his show. Now, I didn't hear the Rush Limbaugh show, so I can't really comment myself on his presentation of the material, but what in the world is Rush Limbaugh doing talking about comets that are impending and possibly going to hit Earth and destroy it? So that's the big question. The question about the story of the comet is really moot because it was never a story in the first place. But let me go on to explain once again, for the second time in 4 months, why this story was bogus right from the beginning. Because to calculate and get data for a comet to, or any object to move and be close to Earth or to predict where it's going to be any place in the solar system, first of all, you typically need a long-term tracking of data, not just, oh, I happen to look through my telescope and there it is, and maybe the next night looked again and made some calculations. First of all, in a comet, the nucleus, you don't even see the nucleus. You just see a big fuzzy ball, and it's maybe anywhere between 10,000 and 100,000 miles in diameter, this big fuzzy ball of gas around the comet nucleus. You cannot see the nucleus from Earth, so how on Earth are you going to get some kind of a reading on the location of the nucleus in there? Well, you can't. It's ridiculous. And so what you need is, and then you would have to go back and say, well, let's find this in old star charts and old pictures that have been taken maybe years ago to get another data point far, far out away from the current set of data points, so that you can get kind of a normalized orbit, so you can get a good, say, second and third data points on this orbit of this particular object. And even then, you're still dealing with something that the cloud is 10,000 to 50,000 to 100,000 miles in diameter, and somewhere in there is the nucleus. So you can't even see the nucleus, so how are you going to get any kind of data on this to get its velocity, its direction, its position, etc.? You cannot. Okay, then, if you could get that data, which you couldn't in this case, even back in June or whenever this guy claimed to see this object, then you would need some very serious computing power. Because not only, it's not like hitting a baseball with a rock in space. Because once this comet or object starts getting close to Earth, you get gravitational interactions of both the Moon and our Earth taking over, plus all the interactions of Jupiter and all the other planets, which are going to affect it somewhat. But as it gets closer to Earth, very strange things start to happen to orbits. They start to slow down and drop into other orbits, so you just don't make these calculations on the back of an envelope. You need some serious computing power. Obviously, this Russian astronomer did not have that capability, and he didn't, obviously, mention anything about this in this announcement. I remember at the time many people were trying to contact this Russian astronomer, and nothing, he would not respond. So very interesting that this whole thing went away last May, in or June, I mean. And remember that May and June are the announcements for the disinformation crew to put out phony comet crashing into Earth stories or asteroid crashing into Earth stories. May is the chosen time, but they drift into June quite a bit too. So clearly this was a disinformation release by the disinformation crew. A lot of times they use foreign papers, either the BBC or Russian papers or French papers or other things. Australian, you know, we've seen it all. But anyway, the point is, okay, so this story was bogus in the first place, June 10th, 2006. The real question is, why would Rush Limbaugh, of all people, announce this on his October 10th show? You tell me, everybody out there. That's strange. And then on the same day, it appeared some other places actually being reposted. The same story, but being reposted with a new date of October 10th. So, anyway, I'm not going to try and analyze why people are doing what they're doing. It's just strange. At any rate, on to the next topic. Just a quick commentary on the Nobel Prize. I put a posting on my page. It's now on the peer review subpage of my homepage, the jmccanniescience.com homepage. And for listeners who want to go there, the abbreviated website name, URL for my webpage, www.jmccsci.com. That's seven letters, jmccsci.com. No dots or dashes, just jmccsci.com, short for J. McCanny Science. But JMCCSCI, and go down to the peer review subpage, and I've got a long commentary on the Nobel Prize. But once again, in 1978, Wilson and I forget, there's a couple people involved in the Nobel Prize of 1978, was given for the first measurement of the microwave background radiation. And at the time they said it proved the Big Bang. Well, of course it didn't. It was just the measurement of some radiation coming from outer space. And clearly this radiation is coming from our solar nebula, something that's very immediate around our sun and is immediate around every other star. So you could calculate that, number one, this would be a porous radiation, not even from all over the universe. See, and that's one of the strange things, too, about the whole issue of microwave background radiation, is that initially it was calculated that it should be extremely uniform because the Big Bang happened a little while ago, quite a long time ago. Whenever things happen a long time ago, the energy has had time to become uniform. Just like the surface of the sun is supposed to be uniform according to the internal core fusion model of the sun. Nothing could be farther from the truth, because the surface of the sun is wild. And so it was in 1979 I clearly recognized that the fusion of the sun had to be at the surface, and that the fusion was caused by energetic lightning bolts in the atmosphere, kind of a stormy, and this same process was going on in Jupiter and in Saturn. So, but anyway, back to the microwave background radiation, you would have to get out, and I've notified through contacts to the Nobel Committee and to the general scientific community, and especially the people at Goddard and JPL, where these two Nobel Prize winners of 2006 were associated, and I said, you can't make this claim that this microwave background radiation you're seeing is from the Big Bang until you get outside of our own solar environment, which extends out to about three times the distance to Pluto. So, sorry guys, but until you do that, you have not confirmed anything. And what you're going to do is look back at our sun and realize that what you're seeing is a local signature of our own sun, and you're not going to see it out in the rest of outer space. But be that as it may, the Nobel Prize 2006, setting science back decades, because now people are claiming, well, it won a Nobel Prize, therefore it, just like the Big Bang argument itself, it's cyclic, in that there was a lot of politics, especially from NASA. Can you imagine the politics going on behind the scenes from NASA to get the Nobel Committee to award a prize for its project? Something that's never been done before. So politically, a Nobel Prize of 2006. On to the next topic. Korean underground nuclear test. Now, I don't know why the U.S. cannot confirm this, because we have sensors all over the world that are for the express purposes. They have been in place since the 1950s. To detect underground tests all over the world. Remember when the French were doing it, and the English had a hand in it, the U.S. was doing it, Russia was doing it back and throughout the Cold War era, and we could tell immediately who set off a test and where. So it's kind of incredible now in 2006 that the U.S. is claiming they can't detect or confirm that North Korea has performed underground nuclear tests. But the alleged unconfirmed story is that North Korea set off a nuclear bomb underground, causing a 6.5 earthquake in Japan. Now, were these simultaneous natural events, the earthquake being a natural event, or was in fact the nuclear bomb set off in North Korea the cause of a 6.5 earthquake in Japan? Well, whether it was or wasn't, there's a bit of anger going on, and the international community turns out they're getting a little upset with the U.S. for their failed diplomacy, because it is basically throwing matches on gasoline cans all around the world. At any rate, enough of that, but just a quick commentary also. Why do these small nations have nuclear capability? Well, it's because of the U.S. university policy, where you can hardly go into a university and find anybody that speaks English anymore. These people come here, you pay for their education, and they leave, and American students cannot get into the universities. Our universities are filled with foreign students. It's nice to have some foreign students to round out the student body, but as I said, at this point, you cannot go to a university where you don't find just about everybody from a foreign country. What's wrong with this picture? So the bottom line, though, is that when I went to school, took physics, and got my degrees, this was back in the 60s and early 70s, it was very important. National security was very important. I mean, you were told certain things, and you were told these are dealing with sensitive items. We all knew in college how nuclear bombs worked, but we weren't going to go sell that information to the Russians or somebody, and we knew Russian students on the other side of the globe were getting the same information. But now, it's just like a free-for-all. There's no control on education, and these people then go back to their countries. It's only a matter of time till they're going to develop a nuclear capability. So we have basically given them the information with which to make nuclear bombs for free. You've paid for it. At any rate, just a quick bit of information. I'll make this as brief as possible. Once again, if you want information on the water filter, the Berkey water filter with the four black Berkey filters and the free shortwave radio, call the number 800-983-5622. Also, I have a book offer there for people who want to get a good start on reading the material. I've got my four-book set, which includes the Weather Book, the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes Book, Surviving Planet X Passage, and the Atlantis to Tesla Colburn Connection Book, plus two videos, the 2003 lecture I gave at the UFO Congress, dealing with the history of my work, and then the 2004 follow-on lecture, Electric Highways to the Star, dealing with electric propulsion systems that I've developed. Anyway, once again, 800-983-5622. If you go to my website, you will find all of the information, 2.2 gigabytes of information on my webpage. That webpage, once again, www.jmccsci.com. jmccsci.com. And for people who want to order by mail order, the address is JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. And once again, my recommendation there is just order the $60, that's the four-book set that includes shipping to the 50 states. And once again, the address is JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. Send $60 for the four-book set. And that includes shipping. On to the next topic. And thank you, listeners, all the people who have been listening for many years. I try and keep my advertisements short. I think everybody needs a good gravity feed water filter. And that Berkey is the best one I've found. So, but by the way, thanks, listeners. I used to have a show where there were no advertisements. Now I put that little insert in there. And, of course, the shortwave show, it costs some quite a bit more than my previous, just the Internet show, so that helps offset the costs. And anyway, thanks, listeners, for being patient while I insert that little message. Also, I think it's a benefit to you. It's something that not only is a benefit to me, but it's a benefit to you. I think you really need these water filters in case something goes down here, and we're any day I would suspect that something big is going to happen in the U.S. Bio warfare is some kind of crazy, goofy thing from our so-called leaders. But at any rate, on to the next topic. NASA has nothing going on. When's the last time you saw something that NASA did in the news? Not going to dwell on this. Month after month, collecting a paycheck and not doing a thing. Collectively. The Popocatepetl Weekly Update. Popocatepetl, the large volcano becoming active again outside of Mexico City. to the southwest, about 50 miles away from the city. To the southeast of the city. And September 22nd, September 26th, September 30th, October 3rd, erupting with gas and dust and ash plumes. That four-day cycle, very consistent, and I'm watching for that to change, the rhythm of that, of course, as the volcanoes start to get closer to an explosion, that rhythm starts, the periodicity of that rhythm starts to shorten. The events start to become closer together, almost like the birthing pains or whatever. But at any rate, on to the next topic. The solar system weather for the week. The solar weather this week was fairly mild, but we are in that zone of the August return current sheet where Earth passes through this large current sheet during the month of August. That's the cause of the peak hurricane season. That's the key to understanding the peak of the tornado severe weather season in the northern hemisphere, the western hemisphere, and also the aurora season peaks in August. And the reason for that is because we have a return current sheet that comes from the far reaches of the solar system, from the solar nebula passing back towards the sun, and we pass through that current sheet in the month of August. So that causes all kinds of problems. At this time, we are moving out of that, and that's what can cause all of us the snap severe weather all of a sudden. And by the way, of course, these storms are driven electrically from the ionosphere. You can read about that in my weather book. So I saw some very interesting telltale signs where a tornado came up through kind of the countryside and then came down right down a road and rode right down the power poles. Very interesting. I saw this personally. This was a number of weeks ago when the large F3 tornado came through western Minneapolis area. I was about a mile from that at the time, and it was pretty wild, let me tell you. And then I went down and looked where the tornado came through, and it rode right down the road and right down the power lines. Just snapped them off, one right after another, and the buildings on both sides of that were unharmed. So very interesting, the tornado following right down the power lines. And of course, that also indicating that the tornado was electrically driven. Now, just a little bit more on the solar cycle. We are definitely in a minimal solar condition right now. Astronomers believe that they have seen the solar the sunspots reverse their magnetic fields, which is the turnover point of the solar cycle starting into the next 11-year solar cycle. But I have not heard that confirmed from multiple sources, so I can't say for sure. But definitely the sun is in a minimal state, not like maybe 2 years ago. What was very strange about the past solar cycle is it kept going on and on, something like that little pink bunny with the batteries advertisement on TV. It just kept going and going and going. And by the way, I think the latest ad they had is very cute. The bunny is going around and these trucks are going by aliens on the road. And the aliens are hitchhiking. And here comes the ever-ready bunny, comes along, gives them a ride down to their spaceship. And he charges up their spaceship to get it going again, and they're very thankful, so they go up and they're beamed up into their spaceship. In the very last scene, the ever-ready buddy's looking into the camera, beating on his little drum, and zap, up into the spaceship he goes. Very, very creative, very cute commercial. So my hat's off to the people who came up with that commercial. Very, very nice commercial. Anyway, where is global warming? Now, this is something that has stunned me. It's October. On October 10th and 11th, I'm, of course, live in Minnesota. The temperature is 32 degrees and it's snowing. We have squall snowstorms moving through, which would normally be small, minor thunderstorms or just rainstorms. And I was driving in my car, and I could see a long expanse to the south, and right over me was clear blue sky, but 5 miles to my south was a thunderhead, literally an anvil, a classic anvil thunderhead, and I could see the city lights below it just glowing up into this flurry of a snowstorm, and really a blizzard going on over there. So here I am with clear blue skies, can see the stars above me, blue sky, it's at night, and I'm looking across like 5 miles of open expanse to the south. I see the thunderhead anvil, classic anvil cloud with snow just dumping. I mean, it's just a tremendous amount of snow coming down. And then the city lights, and it just looked like this big flurry of snow, which it was. But this very small, concentrated thunderstorm moving through, and many of these were moving through. And I actually drove through one at one point, and it was really throwing my vehicle around. It was a lot of wind, a lot of snow, and then all of a sudden it was there, and all of a sudden it stopped. So very strange storm conditions, extremely strange storm conditions in these small, but these are electrically driven. You wouldn't have that anvil cloud. Is the way they are built is the clouds build up and up and up and up until the top is sheared off by the upper layer winds. And that's what creates an anvil cloud, that view of it kind of tapering off into the distance. So very interesting cloud formations, storm conditions, and very what we call micro snow in Minnesota. Now, on to the next topic. This came in from a number of sources, people sending in a giant camel, the remains of a giant camel discovered in Syria, the Syrian Department of Antiquities and Museums in Damascus on Monday, this past Monday, released photos of what this camel would have looked like, living about, they say, 100,000 years ago. It was found, they say, about 250 kilometers northeast of Damascus. Now, just a comment on size. This camel is about twice as high as the current day camel. Now, we think of camels as fairly large animals. This animal is big. And now, I wonder why they put the date 100,000 years on there. After just discovering it, I wouldn't put my hat on that date. How about 4,000 years ago, possibly? But anyway, on the issue of mass, let's take a sphere, for example, linear distance versus area versus volume. Now, if you have a circle, the radius of radius r, the area of the circle goes up as r squared. So let's say you have a unit circle, the area of the resulting circle, if you double the radius, is four times as much area as the original unit circle of radius one. Now, if you're talking about volume, let's take a sphere of radius equal to one, and let's double the radius and look at the volume in the sphere. The volume goes up as r cubed, so it would be twice as big, so that's 2 cubed, so that's 8 times the volume, or 8 times the mass, in this bigger camel, which is twice as tall as the regular current-day camel. And, of course, when the white man, when the European came to the North American continent, there were giant elk, there were 500-pound beavers, and these big animals were extinguished very quickly because they shot them and trapped them. And of course, the bigger animals take much more area to live, much more foliage to eat, etc. But this big camel also would be indicative of a much greener area for these big camels to exist in the Syrian desert. So, obviously, something drastically changing their climate, vegetation, and the size of the animals. So, clearly, something happened and they put 100,000 years ago date on this, I don't really believe that, because we got the little issue of the mastodons. Everybody who's really studies mastodons knows the woolly mammoths, etc., knows that they lived up to about 4,000 years ago, and that really doesn't fit into the standard explanation of time in our on our planet. Excuse me. So anyway, just a very interesting note there, and that came from the Syrian Department of Antiquities, and I'm not sure, this came from all over, so I'm not sure where the best place to go look at that. I would say if you're doing a search, actually came from AP, this one from the AP wire, but look under Syrian Department of Antiquities and Museums, and I suppose search on camels or giant camel would be the search words. Okay. Once again, required viewing for my audience, the movie V for Vendetta. Required viewing, and I won't say why, just watch it, and I think you will understand. A very well-made movie, made on a somewhat lower budget by the same people that made the Matrix series of movies. And you can kind of tell in that the same people made it, but excellent movie, V for Vendetta. On to the science topic of the night. And it's something that I am very concerned about. I've been in education. I've taught at the college level. And I am I'm amazed at what people call education. I remember back in the days of the Greeks, I was always impressed that Aristotle and the great masters, and this is throughout the Middle Ages also, the masters would take in students and teach them. And the students were free to be creative, and they lived this, they breathed it, they worked it. When I went to physics, took my physics at St. Mary's College, now St. Mary's University, in Winona, Minnesota, as an undergraduate, we had a key to the physics department. Every physics student, every physics major had a key, was a master key to all the doors of all the labs. And we had a library over there. And that department went day and night 24/7. We were always over there. There was always some upperclassman that could help you with a problem. We talked physics. We learned physics. We worked together on physics. When we built an experiment, say we did the Michelson-Morley experiment, or say we did the charge on the electron, some experiment dealing with basic physics, whatever. We built the experiment, and when we got done, we took the experiment apart completely. We had to go get the wire, cut the right size of wire. If we had a thermostat or if we had some component, we had to go and pick the right one. We had we had all the materials there. The head of the department had gotten a lot of stuff from, say, military surplus, et cetera, that type of thing. We had transformers. We had rheostats. I mean, every possible thing. When transistors first came out, we got the transistors, bought resistors, we built circuit boards. Everything we did was from scratch. And believe me, you had to have a good knowledge of electronics, of other. We had a machinist, a full-time machinist, that if we needed parts, that machinist was there to make them for us. So it was an amazing education where we had to learn physics. We had to breathe it. We had to live it. Now I go to, in fact, this is one of the things that got me into a little bit of trouble when I was at Cornell, is I went into one of the undergrad labs, and there were bins, and in the bins was everything you needed to do an experiment. There was the power supply, the wires were cut to exactly the right length, already stripped at the end. The size of the wires were already determined for you. You didn't have to do anything. All you had to do is take the stuff from that bin, take it over to the experimental bench, put it together according to the diagram they gave you, and within an hour, you had to be done and out of there because the next crew was going to come in. And so I said to the guy who was the head of of this lab, I said, I don't consider this an education experience. These kids come in, everything's done for them. How are they going to learn anything? And of course, this was this particular professor's pride and joy. He thought this was the best lab ever because he set it all up. And of course, I just stomped all over his little ego. And anyway, the repercussions were severe. But anyway, I've never been one to pull punches or not speak my mind, have I? Anyway, the point is that in a stifling educational environment where, now look at what the teachers have to do in a university environment, or in high school. High school is worse. A teacher cannot put anything into the classroom that did not come from the designed curriculum. There is a document that every teacher has to produce, and sometimes they don't produce them. They're given this document by the school. It's basically the curriculum for the class. And you could be sued if you talk about anything besides what is in that. You have a very tight rope to walk on, and you can't go outside of that. So where's the creativity in modern education? Well, it's been stifled by parents who are so afraid that little Junior is going to hear something that's just too big for his ears. Oh, isn't that terrible? Oh, no. Junior might hear something, or little daughter, and oh, it's just going to be terrible. So they... We're getting on my little bandwagon here, but education really is in a bad state today. I'm sorry to say that, but creativity has been stomped on and extinguished from our educational process. So the question is, what does a student do? I don't care if you're in kindergarten and you're in grade school it gets bad, junior high it gets worse, senior high it gets worse, college is terrible, and grad school is really bad, as far as creativity is concerned. As I've said before, if you were a graduate student and you came up to your graduate advisor and you said, you know, I know you've been working your whole life on this, but I think you're wrong. This Big Bang stuff or this dirty snowball comet model. And, you know, I've been listening to Jim McCanney's show and he's saying this. Do you know what would happen to you? Do you know how fast you would be shown the door? Do you know how fast you wouldn't get a PhD? Do you know how you would never ever get into any place else to get a PhD? So where's the creativity? Where's the ability to talk and express ideas? When I was at Cornell, I got a kick out of the, I was standing outside this was at the end. When I was in the mathematics department, I was publishing my papers there on the electrical nature of the solar system, and this was at the end of my second year there in the mathematics department, and the astrophysicists of Cornell found out that that's where I was located, and they got very angry that I was publishing papers in astrophysics journals from the math department. On my electrical nature of the solar system. And so anyway, they got over there and tried to route me out. And during that time period, I went over and I was going to talk to a professor in the geology department. And this is what happened. I walk into the geology department, Cornell University, and the department chairman is back in his office behind the secretary. And I said, "Hi, I'm Jim McCanney. I'm over here to see so-and-so, this other professor," and the head of the department yells out of his room, "Nobody that talks about Velikovsky will ever get a PhD in my department." And of course, the graduate students down the hall and the professor that I was going to talk to, that I came over and he was going to talk to me, wouldn't talk to me at that point. He wouldn't have anything to do with me. So, at any rate, that just gives you an inkling of the creativity being smashed. And, of course, at the time, these guys thought they were right, but they didn't have and the data was coming in to Cornell from the Voyager spacecraft. It was very clear to me that this was electrical data. This was data that indicated electricity going on in the solar system. It's almost hilarious now to see the Cassini in the Galileo, and then subsequently the Cassini scientists at NASA falling all over themselves to try and pretend like they've been talking about electrical currents and electric fields field aligned currents, etc., ring currents, all of this, that this is a part of standard astrophysics now. Believe me, it wasn't a part of it then. But at any rate, that's what I call the creeping crud, the constant gradual adopting of my material into standard science without really saying that they're doing it. But be that as it may, back to the student. What do you do? This is kind of a rounding out the story a little bit, but as a student, what do you do in a university environment that doesn't want to hear your opinion? Well, there's a lot of basic physics available, and this is for the general public too, by the way. If you're not a graduate student in physics or related fields, there's a lot of fields that are not so cloistered, but astrophysics, astronomy, space science are the worst. Is almost like a religion. But this affects all the other fields, like I say, geology, biology, evolutionary education, etc. The difference between creationism and evolution. You know, and the very valid point comes up, if we're scientists, how can somebody confirm a theory when nobody was there to measurement, especially something dealing with where we came from, where biological systems came from, etc. But once again, back to the student, and this is the same story for the man on the street, for the woman on the street, the person who, whether you're a blue-collar worker, whether you drive a truck, or whether you're an attorney or a doctor, whatever your profession, whatever you do out there in the real world for adults, or if you're a stay-at-home mom and you sometimes think about this, you go out and you look at the night sky and you look at the stars and you go, gee, where did all this come from? You know, the same thing is true. You are dominated by government-supported science. The information that comes to you through the news media, through Rush Limbaugh, or through the newspaper, whatever, a magazine that you pick up at the newsstand, the weather report every night is based on archaic old models. Every place you turn, this government-supported and dominated science, and remember that we're dealing with Tier 2 science, and that's a good point, too. I should just throw that in here, dealing with the Nobel Prize. The Nobel Prize this year for the Big Bang Theory is a premier example of Tier 2 science being exonerated through politics. Because that's what they want the public to see. They don't want the public to see the real issues going on what's going on behind the scenes. And they want the public to be dumbed down. They don't want excitement of science within the public community, because they think that's their personal little playground. It's theirs only, and you can't be a part of it. That's a very selfish, weird attitude of the Tier 1 scientists who you will never see or hear from, but who have the primo equipment that run the black ops operations. And that information, by the way, goes up the chain to the world, basically the people running the world show. Behind the scenes, the people you never hear their names, the people who own the banking system of the entire world, etc. So that's where the Tier 1 scientists move their data. So here you are, general public student, and you're down here trying to get an education with Tier 2 science being passed out on the plate to you. And every now and then some student pokes his head up above the rooftop and goes, there's something else going on around here, and I don't think it's what they're teaching me here. What on earth does that student do? What does the person, what is the doctor, what is the attorney, what is the housewife, what is the average guy on the street, what does the grade school kid do, what does the high school kid do who has no time allowed for creativity? And this is another thing. You go to school, and it seems like the more homework they give you, the harder it is and the better it is. And, you know, there's something to doing homework and doing all your classwork, so I'm not saying don't do that, but it doesn't leave time for creativity. And this is going to get to the main point of what I want to talk about right now. Creativity, to be creative, you need large amounts of time. You need long lengths of silence without the radio, without the TV, without the neighbor's TV on, without the neighbor's boombox going or whatever. You need long periods of time. Silence. You need time for that brain to turn over and start working. And it doesn't happen in 10 or 15 minutes. I'm going to quick go do my homework. I'm going to quick go read this book. It takes time. You have to start looking at things. One thing, I'll just tell you what I did as a kid, growing up studying physics. I had a room all to myself, and I had a giant desk with big shelves on it. And I had good lighting there, and I would sit up in that room for hours doing physics and thinking about things and understanding. And I didn't just work the equations. I understood how things work, and I could visualize them. It takes time. You don't do that in a short amount of time. It doesn't just happen like in 10 or 15 minutes. I'm going to quick do this problem. I got the right answer. I have knowledge. Nope. You have to, because what you need is you need building blocks. If you don't know how a lever works or a balanced scale, or if you don't know how gravity works or the 1 over r squared force, or if you don't know how many things work in their most fundamental aspect, then how are you going to take that and build that as a building block? Too many astronomers, and this is one thing I will lay out a criticism of astronomers, too many astronomers have a very weak background in physics, but when they get that PhD, they start talking like they're plasma physicists, right? And they really don't have the background. So what they do is they read what's in a book, and they can go around and they can spew the lingo. They can use the terms, but they really don't know where that came from, why it's there, or why it's maybe wrong. They're just repeating what they heard. So I call them textbook repeaters. 99% of all astronomers are simply textbook repeaters when it comes to talking about theoretical physics. They didn't take a lot of physics. They didn't, in undergraduate school, they didn't take a lot of mathematics, because they were busy learning other things, and that's fine. But don't pretend you're something that you're not. That's what I'm saying. You're not a plasma physicist. You're not a physicist that understands the, you know, a lot of other type of things. You need a very solid physics training to understand these, and that's why when I get in a room with real physicists, I can hold my own with them because I have a good background. And they know it, and that's why a lot of NASA scientists don't want to go in the ring with me and talk about my material. They would rather just steal it piece by piece and claim that they discovered it rather than actually talk about the whole entourage that the entire basis of theoretical work that they're using is wrong. The Big Bang never occurred. There's no dirty snowball. But what does a student do when they go into a classroom, and this is what they're teaching you, and in the back of your mind, you're going, everything they're telling me here is wrong. Everything in this textbook is based on incorrect premises, so all the subsequent small minor theories are incorrect too. What does that student do? And this is a giant dilemma today, so my recommendation is to get your degree, do what you have to do, but also make that time to go out and let your brain work. My idea of education is that a university or a college should have an excellent library. How many times in a library do you see a student in the library just going amongst the books and say, you know, I'm in physics, I'm in chemistry, but I want to learn about archaeology today, and goes over and talks to the archaeology professor, or I want to learn about microbiology today and goes over and starts doing something else. You don't have time, do you? You're just strapped to what you're doing. And that's part of the technique of controlling people's once they get out. Where are they going to go? What are they going to do? What are they going to talk about? And most people don't have the energy to get out and become creative. And that's why, you know, we have, say, good engineers and that type of thing, but we don't have good creativity when it comes to science, real basic science, because that creativity is stifled all the way through your educational process. And this, to me, is a crime. And so they talk about spending more money on education or No Child Left Behind. This is all chatter. It's all wording up, trying to make something sound good. But in reality, the only way to really improve education is to allow students to become creative. And I guarantee you, when those students become creative, they're going to surpass what their superiors do. And that's one thing that I find amazing, too, is that there is the students do not surpass what their predecessors have done. In fact, in the science astrophysics world, there hasn't been any progress in 30 to 40 years. Now, as I said, NASA scientists, some of the better ones, are starting to creep along and pick up the electrical conditions in the solar system idea, but they still have no fundamental knowledge of where it comes from. Some of them are starting to read my material and pick up on it, but they still cannot cross that barrier and say, you know, everything fundamentally that we're doing here is wrong. We need a new basis here to account for this electricity, because in the standard theoretical world of astrophysics and space science, electricity has crept in kind of from the side in a world where there wasn't supposed to be any electricity or magnetism. Remember that they were surprised when they found that Jupiter had a magnetic field. That was a total surprise. And so they thought Jupiter was just this cold ball of frozen hydrogen out there. That was the expectation when they sent the first spacecraft to Jupiter. And they thought that the big red spot, the great red spot, was just kind of a blotch on the surface. So when they found out it had winds and this thing was changing and it was like a big cyclonic storm, people were amazed. But now, see, you don't remember that. Nobody talks about what they really expected out there. And the same with Saturn. They expected Saturn to be a bunch of little dusty particles that were left over from the formation of the solar system. And that view was prevalent when I was at Cornell in 1980, 81, 79. Those years, that's still what when I wrote my first paper on Saturn's sweeper moons predicted, the referee, who was a guy from Cornell, wrote back and he says, well, it's well known that the particles around Saturn, the ring particles, are just little dust particles and asteroids and little chunks of matter left over from the formation of the solar system. And clearly, that was not the case, but, you know, papers would be rejected from publication because of incorrect views, something that's still going on today. So where on earth does a student go who wants to be creative? The point is, you have to make your own time to become creative, because you're not going to get it at that university that you're paying $50,000 a year to go to. You're certainly not going to get it there. You're not going to get it to the college you're going to paying $20,000 to $25,000 a year. You're not going to get it there. You're not going to get it in the public high school or the private high school where you go. You're not going to get it there because they have a set curricula, and that's what they're going to do. That's what they're going to feed you. And this brings up a topic that back in the late 60s, there was a book published called The Peter Principle. The Peter Principle amounts to the following. Here's the base. The book was written by Dr. Lawrence J. Peter and another gentleman named Raymond Hall, first published in 1969, and it came out as education systems were starting to fail in the United States. Here is the premise of the Peter Principle. It says, in quotes, in a hierarchy, every employee, or this could mean teacher or whatever, every employee tends to rise to his level of incompetence. And this is what happens a lot of times in corporations that are old. employees keep advancing. Of course, since they've done a good job at the previous job, the employer thinks, well, you can do a good job and I need somebody in this position. So the people keep moving up until they can't do the job, and then they don't advance any farther, but that's where they stay. So in government, we see that is rampant. We have hundreds of thousands of people working in Washington who are incompetent in the agencies. They go there and they just sit there, state agencies, county agencies, the same situation, and especially in education, where teachers go in, they're young teachers, they're enthusiastic, but after 3 or 4 years, they're pretty tired of being in that classroom every day, every day. So they want to move up, so they go into administration, and all of a sudden, the Peter Principle applies. Now, how does this apply to education? Well, it applies to education in that, I'm going to talk about scientific theory. The Peter Principle applies also. In other words, you have a set of theories that come along. They are published in journals. They're put in textbooks. They're advanced. People talk about them. It comes out in the newspaper. It's on the evening news. People get Nobel Prizes for them. And then all of a sudden, these theories have come to their level of incompetence, so to speak, because they can't change. Now they're locked in as the permanent knowledge. I remember when computers first came in, they talked about knowledge-based systems, and people thought, gee, if we could go out and get all the experts in the world, and they could all contribute their knowledge into this computer database, then we would have all the knowledge in the world in one spot, and nobody would ever have to think again, because, hey, we've got all the experts with all the knowledge. But, one little problem. That knowledge changes, and people come along and say, well, you know, this isn't right, and that wasn't right. Well, how do you change the knowledge base once it's locked in and somebody has millions of dollars or billions of dollars locked in these textbooks, locked in their theories? You have Nobel Prizes given for this information. How do you undo that? And that's the problem. That's the Peter Principle applied to science. That's where we are today in astrophysics. So, at any rate, I just want a quick comment on the Iapetus, moon of Saturn. This picture actually was released a number of years ago. Very interesting close-up picture of the small round moon, Iapetus, circling Saturn. And it has like as if you took the two semicircles and just crunched them together. And when you look close at high resolution, it basically is a mountain ridge, an upthrust mountain ridge that circles the planet like an equator, or like a ring around the planet, around the center of the moon, this round moon. And so anyway, clearly it is a ring of upthrust mountains, and the only way that this could happen is if a large object came by and jarred that surface of the moon, causing the mantles to slip over probably a liquid or molten core and ram up against these two plates, ramming up against each other and, of course, forming the upthrust mountains. You can see the jagged mountain ridges, in the high resolution. So very interesting, Iapetus, moon of Saturn, with a ring of upthrust mountains around it. Now, clearly, this is not the result of slow plate tectonics, because the formation, and that's one of my the things that I contend also, is that the mountains on Earth, and of course this is directly from Velikovsky, that the mountains on Earth are in fact due to large objects passing by, certainly not due to plate tectonics. And I am really out of time, so this is Jim McCanny, this is my Science Hour, and once again, we are at the crossroads. Good night.